We would like to send out a special thanks to Sock Club for supporting The Trail Went Cold. And we would like to thank you, the listeners, by offering you the chance to earn 15% off your next order of socks when you visit sockclub.com/cold and use the discount code COLD. That's sockclub.com/cold and the discount code is COLD. Enjoy the show. December 22nd, 1967. Chicago, Illinois. After leaving work and picking up his son from school, Dr. John Branion returns home to discover that his wife Donna Branion has been shot to death. When a Walther PPK and four bullets are discovered to be missing from the home, Dr. Branion is charged with the murder. Even though Branion appears to have a solid alibi, and his defense team argues there was not enough time for him to have killed his wife, he is found guilty at trial, but flees the country after attempting to appeal the verdict. Branion is eventually recaptured, and dies in 1990, but questions remain about whether the right person was convicted of the crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our newest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're going to be covering a pretty controversial case on the podcast today, the 1967 murder of Donna Branion. This case is pretty unique in that it's technically solved, but a lot of debate still surrounds what actually happened. The story was featured on Unsolved Mysteries as one of their final appeal segments, in which they would examine a case where someone had been convicted of a crime, but there was some doubt about whether they were actually guilty. A lot of notable stories were featured as final appeal segments, including the Tommy Ziegler case, which I covered on the podcast last year. In this particular segment, the appellant was Donna Branion's husband, John Branion, a prominent African-American physician who also happened to have a personal connection to Martin Luther King Jr. When the case was covered on Unsolved Mysteries in 1989, Branion was in desperate need of a heart transplant, which he was not going to get if he was a convicted murderer. He was really hoping to clear his name, but passed away within the next year. Now obviously, because the accused is now deceased, this isn't going to be a serial or making a murderer type of situation. No matter what we say here, this case is closed, and barring a surprise revelation, is going to remain closed forever. However, there's still a lot of ambiguity about whether Branion murdered his wife, so I'm going to explore each angle, as this might not actually be a simple, straightforward case of did he or didn't he do it. I should also mention that since we've started the new month of December, I've selected a few Christmas-themed cases to be featured on the podcast these next few weeks. This particular crime took place a couple of days before Christmas, and since this month will officially mark the 50th anniversary, it seemed like an ideal time to cover it. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the controversial murder of Donna Branion. Our story begins in Chicago in 1967. Our central figures are a 41-year-old African-American physician named John Marshall Branion Jr. and his 41-year-old wife, Donna. The couple were high school sweethearts and have been married 21 years, live a very comfortable upper-class lifestyle in the affluent Hyde Park suburb, and have two children, a 13-year-old daughter named Jan, and an adopted 4-year-old son, John Marshall Branion III, who goes by the name Joby. Dr. Branion is known for being a civil rights activist in the community, and attained some extra notoriety in 1966 by becoming the personal physician of none other than Martin Luther King Jr. Branion would treat King whenever he visited Chicago, and even walked alongside him on a few civil rights marches. He also generated some controversy by providing medical services for extreme revolutionary groups, such as the Black Panthers. If any of them were shot, Branion would treat their wounds without reporting them to the police, which kind of made him an adversary of the state's attorney's office. At one point, he also ran into legal trouble when he was indicted for allegedly being a member of an illegal abortion ring, but the charges were dropped when a woman who was set to testify against him died before the trial. Even though he specialized as an obstetrician and gynecologist, Dr. Branion practiced general medicine at a clinic at Ida Mae Scott Hospital. On the morning of December 22nd, Branion saw patients as usual at the clinic before leaving the hospital at around 11:30 a.m. According to John, he drove about a mile and a half to the nursery school, the Hyde Park Neighborhood Club, in order to pick up his son Joby. They then traveled a few blocks to the office of Maxine Brown, who happened to be Donna Branion's cousin. The previous night, John had invited Maxine out to lunch with himself and his wife, but when he arrived to pick Maxine up, she told him that she had too many work commitments and could no longer keep their lunch date. So John then left and took Joby to their family's home on South Woodlawn Avenue. When they walked inside the house, John called out for Donna, but was surprised to receive no response, even though the lights were still on and the TV was running. John started searching the house, and soon came across Donna's body lying on the floor inside a utility room in the kitchen. She had been shot multiple times. John shielded Joby from the sight, before taking him out onto the back porch and calling out the name Helen. He was calling for a neighbor named Helen Hudson, who also happened to be Donna's cousin, because he wanted Joby to stay inside her apartment until help could arrive. It wasn't long before the police were called, and the official time of the call would be logged in as 11:57 a.m. When police arrived at the scene and examined Donna's body, they discovered a total of 13 gunshot wounds through her head, neck, shoulders, and back, though some of them were exit wounds, so she had not actually been shot that many times. She had numerous bruises and marks on her body, and a groove on her neck which was 3/8 of an inch deep and 7 inches long. This indicated that Donna had been strangled before she was shot, though strangulation was not the cause of death. There was an overturned table and ironing board inside the utility room, indicating that a struggle had gone on in there. Since an ironing cord was looped around Donna's arm, it had probably been used to strangle her. On the surface, the murder seemed pretty baffling, since Donna was not sexually assaulted, and her husband did not believe that anything was missing from the home, so robbery didn't appear to be the motive. Even though the residence had a special burglar-proof lock, there were no signs of forced entry, so Donna may have let the killer inside. 4 cartridge casings, which appeared to be from a 9mm weapon, were found near Donna's body, along with 3 expended bullets, and a 4th bullet would later be found in her body during the autopsy. Dr. Branion was an avid gun collector, who had around 30 weapons inside the house, so when asked if he owned any guns which fired 9mm bullets, Branion turned over one of his pistols, and tests would later show that it was not the murder weapon. Branion went to the police station for questioning, but was accompanied by Donna's brother, Nelson Brown. While Nelson was an attorney, he did not officially represent John, and was just there to lend him support. John was asked if he would be willing to take a polygraph test, but when Nelson told him it was probably not a good idea, John declined. However, he did say that he would be willing to take a nitrate test, which would determine if he fired a gun earlier that day, but the police did not have the necessary resources to conduct such a test. Anyway, the police let Branion go, but it wasn't long before his actions started raising a few eyebrows. Now here's where we're going to run into the issue of contradictory information from different sources. In 1992, author Barbara D'Amato published a book about this case titled The Doctor, the Murder, the Mystery, The True Story of the Dr. John Branion Murder Case. During the 1980s, she and her husband, Northwestern University law professor Anthony D'Amato, lent their investigative services to Branion's case and firmly believed in his innocence. The book claimed that a lot of the information out there about the case is inaccurate or outright fabricated, even though some of the sources you'll find online are actual court documents from Brannion's legal appeals. Anyway, I'll address these issues a little later, but for now, I'll just provide you with the version of events which the Chicago PD and the prosecution claim happened. When the police attempted to question Brannion again, they were surprised to discover that he had immediately gone down to Colorado with his kids to spend Christmas on a ski trip. And even worse, he had allegedly taken a nurse from his clinic named Shirley Hudson with him. Now, John's kids would later deny that Shirley was ever with them on the trip, but one thing which was true is that she was John's mistress, and they had been conducting an affair for the past 6 years. John and Shirley had developed a bond because Shirley shared his passion for civil rights, while Donna had little interest in them. And Shirley even walked alongside John during one of his marches with Martin Luther King. However, John would later claim that Donna already knew about his affair with Shirley, and while she wasn't particularly thrilled about it, the arrangement was mutually accepted, and Donna did not consider the possibility of a divorce because it would negatively affect her social status. Regardless, investigators now had a potential motive for Brannion to have killed his wife, so they started looking for evidence against him. Police always found it curious that upon finding his wife's body, John immediately ran outside the house without checking to make sure she was dead. Well, given that he was a doctor, John claimed that he could immediately tell Donna was dead from the lividity in her legs, which is what happens when blood settles in the lowest point of the body. But on the day of the murder, Dr. Helen Payne, a neighbor of the Brannions who also happened to be a physician, entered the house and examined Donna's body. She officially pronounced Donna dead at 12:20 p.m., but claimed she saw no signs of lividity in her legs. Since it generally takes at least an hour for blood to settle in the body, this seemed to indicate that Donna had died fairly recently. In his original statement, John allegedly stated that he arrived at the Hyde Park Neighborhood Club Nursery School to pick up his son at 11:35 a.m., and that Joby was already standing outside waiting for him. However, when police spoke to a teacher from the school, she claimed that John's actual time of arrival was around 11:45, and that he walked inside to help Joby put on his coat, and seemed more rushed than usual. However, the most troubling inconsistency with Brannion involved the potential murder weapon. A firearms expert looked at the slugs and cartridge casings found at the scene, and stated that they, quote, had a class characteristic of .380 caliber automatic ammunition with six lands and grooves with a right twist, unquote. He concluded that the only weapon in the world capable of firing this particular brand of ammunition was a Walther PPK. Well, investigators learned from a friend of the Brannions named William Hooks that he had given John a Walther PPK as a birthday present nearly 1 year earlier, yet John had never mentioned it when asked if he had any guns capable of firing 9mm bullets. This was enough for police to obtain a search warrant for the Brannion residence. They would find an empty box containing documentation for a Walther PPK and a manufacturer's target containing a serial number, which allowed investigators to corroborate that William Hooks had purchased this gun for Brannion. In addition, they also found some boxes in a closet containing Gecko brand .380 caliber ammunition, and four shells just happened to be missing from one of the boxes, the same amount of shells which were allegedly used to shoot Donna Brannion. Detectives immediately showed up at Dr. Brannion's clinic to confront him about this. Even though he had initially told them that nothing appeared to be missing from the home on the day of the murder, Brannion now claimed that he had noticed the Walther PPK was missing, along with $500 which he had left on the nightstand for his wife to go Christmas shopping. In addition, police also received a tip that Brannion had thrown a gun into Lake Michigan, but even though this story was never corroborated, and no murder weapon was ever found, they still felt the evidence was strong enough to arrest Dr. Brannion, so on January 22, 1968, he was formally charged with his wife's murder. Anyway, Brannion's trial started in May of that year, but there was a lot of racial tension in the air. On April 4th, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, sparking race riots in a lot of major U.S. cities. Chicago's riot was one of the most destructive, leaving 11 people dead and hundreds more injured. So naturally, there was a lot of controversy surrounding the fact that a highly respected African-American doctor who happened to be King's personal physician was now going on trial for a murder he swore he did not commit. Much to Brandon's disappointment, the jury for his trial would consist of 11 white people, but only one black person. The entire case would hinge on the validity of the prosecution's timeline, and whether it was physically possible for Brandon to have committed the murder during a window of less than half an hour. The prosecution's theory was that after leaving his clinic at the hospital, Brandon drove to his home, went inside and murdered his wife, and then immediately drove to his son's nursery school to pick him up, before driving a few blocks to Maxine Brown's office. Maxine claimed that John had never scheduled a lunch date with her before, and had called her up completely out of the blue between 10 and 11 p.m. the night before the murder. The prosecution believed that this was done so Brandon could fabricate an alibi for himself and have a witness alongside him when he discovered his wife's body, but since Maxine canceled the lunch date at the last minute, this never happened. So after leaving Maxine's office, John then drove straight home with his son, found out his wife had been murdered, and the police were notified. I've seen different sources give varying accounts of the exact time Brandon left the hospital, but it definitely wasn't any earlier than 11:30 a.m., and the hospital's administrator would corroborate that he briefly spoke with Brandon outside the building as he was leaving. Police logs showed that the call for assistance occurred at 11:57, so that left a window of just over 25 minutes for Brandon to leave the hospital, drive to his home, strangle and shoot his wife, drive to the nursery school to pick up his son, drive to Maxine Brown's office, and then drive back home to discover his wife's body and call the police. Since the teacher from the nursery school claimed that Brandon showed up at around 11:45, the actual time required to commit the murder would have been between 10 to 15 minutes. Well, Brandon's defense team argued that this scenario was just not physically possible, but before we get into that, I have to discuss their key character witness, Donna's brother, Nelson Brown. I mentioned earlier that Brandon's supporters have always maintained that a lot of the information used to build a case against him was inaccurate or misconstrued, and Nelson Brown was often called upon to refute it. For example, one of the first things which made John look suspicious was his decision to go on a ski trip to Colorado immediately following his wife's murder, but Nelson insisted that the whole trip was his idea. Nelson and his wife had already planned this trip for themselves, and claimed that he invited John and his kids to join them. John was reluctant to do so at first, but Nelson convinced him that it would be best for the children to get them out of town to avoid the publicity and not have them celebrate Christmas in the same house where their mother was murdered. Even though Maxine Brown claimed that John had called her at home to invite her to lunch, Nelson claimed that both John and Donna invited Maxine to lunch at a dinner party they all attended at Nelson's house that night. While John supposedly told police that he knew Donna was dead because of the lividity in her legs, John maintained that he actually said cyanosis, which is a blue discoloration of the skin caused by deoxygenated blood. That seems like quite a strange mix-up to make, but Nelson testified that he was sitting next to John when he was questioned by detectives and personally witnessed him use the word cyanosis and never saw him use the word lividity. Nelson also debunked the police's claims that John had told them he picked up his son from the nursery school at 11:35 and that Joby was standing outside. And Nelson testified that when John returned home from the police station that night, he discovered that his Walther PPK and another antique gun were missing, along with $500 he'd left on the dresser for Donna. The only reason John did not mention these items were stolen during his original questioning was because he hadn't noticed yet, and Nelson advised John not to contact the police about it because they might try to pin the murder on him. Even so, all this character testimony wouldn't matter too much if Brandon's defense team could prove it was physically impossible for him to have committed the murder. One of their key witnesses would be a neighbor named Teresa Kentra, who lived next door to the Brandons, and testified that on the morning of the murder, she heard some commotion and loud noises which sounded like gunshots from her kitchen. Now, different sources give different accounts about the exact time she heard these noises, ranging from 11:20 to 11:30 a.m., I know that when Kentra was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries about this, she said she glanced at the clock and saw the time was 11:20. But the key point is that if those noises she heard were the sounds of Donna Brandon being murdered, then her husband would have been several blocks away at the hospital at that time. However, the prosecution countered with testimony from another neighbor who also heard loud noises that morning. He was in the midst of making a long-distance phone call and was constantly checking the clock to remain conscious of the time, and he stated that the clock read 11:36 when he heard the noises. Teresa Kentra also shared another piece of information which wasn't too flattering to the defense. She claimed that she caught a glimpse of Dr. Brannion's face moments before he came out onto the back porch and started yelling, "Helen!" According to Kentra, Brannion did not appear to be agitated, so one could infer that his panicked cry for help was nothing more than an act. One of the lead detectives on the case, Michael Boyle, testified that the police had driven the exact route the prosecution was alleging Brannion drove to murder his wife, which would have been a total of 2.8 miles. According to Boyle, Brannion would have had enough time to drive home, murder his wife, pick up his son from school, stop at Maxine Brown's office, and then return home again during the specified time frame. Even though it apparently took them as long as 12 minutes to drive from the hospital to the Brannion residence during a couple of their simulations, for the most part, the entire drive only took them 6 minutes. However, the defense would point out the big flaw in the police's logic is that even though they timed how long it would have taken them to drive the route, they didn't account for how much time it would have taken for Brannion to walk inside these various locations to complete his task. Without a child in tow, how could they accurately measure how much time it would have taken for John to dress Joby in his winter clothing and escort him from the school to the car? How could they possibly know how much time John required to walk inside his house and murder his wife? In the defense's eyes, the prosecution's timeline was highly flawed, and they received a major coup when a pathologist took the stand to testify about the strangulation Donna had endured right before she was shot. Since her voice box and hyoid bone were not damaged, it didn't seem like a lot of pressure was applied while she was strangled, so the pathologist believed that the groove found in her neck, which was 3/8 of an inch deep, would have required her to have been strangled for at least 15 to 30 minutes, and if this assessment was true, then there's no way Brannion would have had near enough time to murder his wife in the 25-minute window presented by the prosecution. The defense was also critical about the fact that crucial evidence which might have pointed to another perpetrator was lost. When Donna's autopsy was performed, clippings from her fingernails and scrapings from under the nails were collected, but before this evidence could be analyzed, it inexplicably disappeared. However, in spite of the defense planting some major doubts about the state's case, it wasn't enough. On May 28th, after deliberating for 8 hours, the jury found Dr. Brannion guilty of the murder of his wife, and he would eventually receive a sentence of 20 to 30 years in prison. But this was definitely not the end of this story. Surprisingly, Brannion was allowed to be released on a bond of only $5,000 in order to appeal the verdict. During that time, he officially got married to his mistress, Shirley Hudson, and the couple had a son named Jeff. But get this, John divorced Shirley to marry another woman, then divorced her to remarry Shirley, and then divorced Shirley again to remarry his previous wife, all in the span of less than 3 years. Unfortunately for Brannion, his appeal was denied, as the Illinois Supreme Court affirmed the conviction, and he was ordered to surrender and begin serving his sentence on June 25, 1971. By this point, Brannion was living in New York, and he made one last-ditch effort to appeal the case all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. But when they declined to hear his case, Brannion obtained a false passport, jumped bail, and fled the country. Brannion would spend the next decade hopping the globe between nearly 20 different countries, most of them in Africa. He even served some time in jail for passport fraud, but always managed to stay one step ahead of the American authorities. At one point, he found asylum in Uganda, and became a prominent physician who treated genocidal dictator Idi Amin, which, needless to say, is a major step down from Martin Luther King. Well, in 1983, Brannion was finally recaptured in Uganda and extradited back to the U.S., where he began serving his 20 to 30 year sentence at Illinois' Dixon Correctional Facility. He continued to maintain that he was completely innocent of his wife's murder, and that he only fled the country as a last resort. For her part, even though John had divorced her twice and abandoned her to raise their children, Shirley Hudson continued to stick by him, and she convinced Anthony and Barbara D'Amato to investigate his case and for Anthony to serve as his appellate counsel. On multiple occasions, the D'Amatos drove the same route Brannion supposedly took that morning to commit murder. They concluded that the police's claims that they could drive from the hospital to the Brannion home in 6 minutes was completely false, and at the very minimum, it would have taken at least 11 minutes. When they examined the original autopsy reports, The D'Amatos believed that at least two assailants had to be involved in Donna's murder, as one of them likely held the ironing cord around her neck, while the other one found John's Walther PPK, loaded it with shells from the closet, and used it to shoot her. Even though you'll find some sources out there which state that the Walther PPK was kept inside a locked weapons cabinet, the D'Amatos say that it was actually kept on a closet shelf and would have been accessible to intruders. Their theory was that the crime was a botched burglary attempt, and that the perpetrators decided to kill Donna because she did not know the combination to a safe they had inside their house. This theory is bolstered by the fact that there had been other burglaries in that neighborhood in the weeks preceding the murder. Another interesting development took place in 1986, when Reginald Holzer, the judge from Brannion's trial, wound up receiving an 18-year prison sentence for extortion and racketeering. William Hooks, the same friend who originally bought the Walther PPK for Brannion, signed an affidavit in which he claimed that Nelson Brown had offered Judge Holzer a $20,000 bribe to overturn the verdict, with $10,000 being paid up front, and the other $10,000 after Brannion was freed. The trial's prosecutor, Patrick Tuitt, heard rumors that Holzer was planning to overturn Brannion's conviction, and had a meeting with the judge in order to urge him to allow the Illinois Supreme Court to make the decision. The rumor was that Holzer got cold feet about overturning Brannion's verdict, so he came up with a compromise in which he set his bond at an uncommonly low $5,000 so that Brannion could potentially flee the country if his legal options failed. However, by the time these bribery allegations surfaced, Nelson Brown was no longer around to address them. He had been stabbed to death in 1983, and as far as I know, that crime was never solved. Now obviously, if Brannion's brother-in-law was attempting to bribe the judge, then you'd think that would look very unfavorable for him, but Brannion's defense team insisted that he knew nothing about this, and their big concern was the fact that Patrick Tuitt had an ex parte conversation with Judge Holzer when he convinced him to overturn the verdict. Technically, a prosecutor and a judge should not be having this type of conversation about a case without all parties present. Since Holzer had made an ex parte decision without consulting Brannion's defense team about this, they felt this should have been grounds to overturn his conviction, but the appeal was denied. During his years on the run, Brannion suffered from numerous medical ailments and wound up having a total of 5 heart attacks, which caused so much cumulative damage that it eventually got to the point where he required a heart transplant. Of course, given that he was a convicted murderer, he was obviously not going to be put on the waiting list for a new heart, so exonerating him of the crime would literally be required to save his life. With all his legal appeals exhausted, Brannion's supporters requested clemency from Illinois Governor James Thompson. Brannion's case aired as a final appeal segment on Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1989, but by that point, he had already been denied clemency from the governor and was on borrowed time. In August of 1990, Brannion was suffering from both a heart condition and a brain tumor. It was in such bad shape that Governor Thompson finally did grant him clemency, commuted his sentence to time served, and released him from prison. But his freedom was short-lived, as he passed away only 1 month later on September 8th, at the age of 64. This pretty much closed the books on Donna Brannion's murder for good, but given the numerous discrepancies in the case's timeline, it remains up for debate. Some people, including the authorities, believe that the right man faced justice all along, but others believe that John Brannion was wrongly convicted of this crime, and that someone else managed to get away with murder. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our new sponsor, Sock Club, as we are very excited that they are now supporting The Trail Went Cold. The holidays are right around the corner, and Sock Club is delivering the perfect gift experience. This is a good time to remind your loved ones that you care each month with quality, American-made socks. The socks are sent straight to your door, featuring a different modern classic design each month that is perfect to add sophisticated fun to any wardrobe. Each package also contains a personalized gift message that can be customized each month. I am pleased to say that I am now teamed up with Sock Club, and they are offering us all 15% off. If you want to give a little reminder of your love every month, then give Sock Club. I just received a shipment of new socks from Sock Club, and it's a good thing too, because we have some pretty cold Canadian winters up here, and I desperately needed them. Before this, My drawer was filled with nothing but plain old boring worn-down black socks, but thanks to Sock Club, I'm going to spend my lead-up to Christmas wearing socks which are not only extremely warm and comfortable, but also very vibrant and colorful, and will help put me into the holiday spirit. So if you want to experience the same thing, take advantage of our special offer and go to sockclub.com/cold and get 15% off when you use the discount code COLD. That's sockclub.com/cold and you use the discount code COLD for 15% off. Thank you and enjoy the rest of our episode. So out of all the final appeal cases featured on Unsolved Mysteries, this is probably the most complex, but I'll get into more detail about that in a little while. For starters, I'll just acknowledge that regardless of whether he's guilty or innocent, there are a lot of things to dislike about Dr. John Branion. He willingly carried on an affair with a mistress for 6 years, and even though he claims his wife tolerated the arrangement, we really only have his word on that. By the sound of things, Donna might have divorced him a long time ago if she wasn't concerned about how it would affect her social status, and it would not surprise me at all if she eventually reached her breaking point. And I think we got a good glimpse of John's character when he married his mistress, Shirley Hudson, and had another child with her after his wife's murder, but then alternated between divorcing her and marrying another woman on multiple occasions within a 3-year period. If that's not a sign of a guy that has serious issues with infidelity, then I don't know what is. Then John winds up abandoning his wife, or should I say, wives, by fleeing the country, rather than start serving his prison sentence. Say what you will about Shirley and her willingness to have an affair with a married man, but she took on the task of raising John's children, two of whom were not even hers, after he took off. But if John was truly guilty of this crime, one of the most messed up things he did was knowingly bringing his 4-year-old son Joby into the house with him to find his mother's body. But you'll be happy to know that Joby Branion did turn out pretty well in the long run, as he became a successful player agent for the National Football League, and currently runs his own talent representation firm called Vanguard Sports Group. In 2011, Joby was interviewed about his mother's murder in a Washington Post article, and he seems to be at peace with the whole situation, and does feel that his father genuinely loved him. Now, I'm sure we can debate Branion's decision to flee the country rather than serve his prison sentence, as it's very easy to say that no innocent man would ever flee like that. However, I do concede that he was facing a sentence of 20 to 30 years and did try to go through the proper legal channels, but his appeal was denied by the Illinois Supreme Court. However, if he surrendered to start serving his sentence, the chances were not great that he'd get his conviction overturned in prison. If I was in a position where I knew I was innocent, would have to serve at least 2 decades in prison for a crime I didn't commit, I'm not sure how I'd handle things, so I won't judge Branion's decision to run too harshly. However, I will gladly make judgments about his association with Idi Amin. Now, Branion's supporters have always said that the claims of him being Amin's personal physician were greatly exaggerated, and that at the most, he only treated Amin a few times. Fair enough, but after he was extradited back to the U.S., Branion gave many interviews about his experiences in Uganda, and actually praised the dictator. No joke, you will find multiple newspaper articles in which Branion refers to Amin as a great man who was very charming and honest, and all the reports of his regime being responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths were false. I'm sorry, no. It kind of blows my mind that a guy who once marched alongside Martin Luther King would champion someone like Idi Amin. But let's stop focusing on Branion's character flaws and discuss whether or not he was actually responsible for the murder of his wife. There's always been a lot of debate about the potential motive. Obviously, John may have wanted to divorce Donna in order to marry his mistress, but the rumor was that Donna refused to get a divorce because of the potential social stigma. And since John went through 3 divorces in 3 years following Donna's death, he obviously wasn't against the whole concept. You might be wondering about a potential financial motive. Donna hailed from a very prominent and wealthy family, as her father was a realtor banker and one of the richest black men in Chicago. But the problem is that Donna wouldn't stand to inherit anything if Donna died. Yes, if Donna's wealthy father died, she would inherit a ton of money, and John would become a potential beneficiary. But since Donna's father was still alive at this point, John did not gain anything financially from her death. I gotta say, while researching this story, the one person I became really intrigued about was Donna's brother, Nelson Brown. Like I said earlier, he served as John's biggest character witness at trial, and seemed to be there to support and defend him at every turn. The first time John was questioned by police, Nelson accompanied him to the station and provided legal advice, even though he was not John's actual attorney. Nelson was there to provide explanations for some of the damning evidence against John, such as his Christmas ski trip to Colorado, and John's failure to report the missing Walter PPK and $500 to the police. According to John, when he discovered the gun had been stolen from his house, his first instinct was to tell the police, but Nelson talked him out of it, and apparently said, "Personally, I'd advise you not to do it. White cops, they're always going to pin it on the black guy." And to top it all off, Nelson supposedly attempted to bribe Judge Dolzer into overturning John's conviction. I know these allegations were never officially proven, but William Hooks, one of John's best friends, did sign an affidavit about it, and it would explain why John was released on bond. Granting bail to someone who has just been convicted of murder is extraordinarily rare, but to do so on a sum as low as $5,000 is pretty insane. Not to mention that this was Chicago in 1968, when race relations were not the best, so a white judge doing this for a black defendant was pretty out of the ordinary to say the least. I do think it's kind of hilarious that Brandon's defense team tried to use these bribery allegations as grounds to overturn his conviction. I mean, I do understand the legalities of why they did that, but let's not forget it was their side who were accused of making the bribe. But the big point I'm trying to make is that if Nelson Brown was willing to go to all these lengths to set Brandon free, then he must have truly believed John was innocent, because otherwise, why would you want to help the guy accused of murdering your sister? I really wish I knew more details about Nelson Brown's murder, though I'm certain it's not connected to this case. But I do wish Nelson had still been alive when these bribery allegations came to light, as it would have been interesting to see how things played out. I certainly would have been curious to hear his thoughts once his brother-in-law returned to the US and began serving his sentence. However, all this talk about Brandon's character flaws and potential motive might be completely irrelevant if the prosecution's timeline doesn't hold together, and it was physically impossible for him to have committed the murder. That is the biggest point his defenders have always raised. They believe there's no way he could have driven to all those different locations and had enough time to kill his wife during a window of about 25 minutes, and I have to say, I'm inclined to agree with them. I know the police claim that they timed themselves driving that route, and that it was possible for Brandon to have pulled this off, but there are a lot of flaws with their logic. They said Brandon could have driven from the hospital to his home in as little as 6 minutes, but it did take them as long as 12 minutes at one point, and that's a major problem. We've seen this experiment conducted in a lot of cases, when someone will drive the route the killer took when they allegedly committed the crime, in order to determine if they could have made it from point A to point B during an allotted time frame. Hell, this is one of the biggest key points in Serial. Well, of course, the big issue with this type of experiment is that no matter how many times you attempt to recreate it, you will never be able to 100% recapture the exact circumstances of the day the crime actually took place. Donna Brandon's murder occurred on a cold winter morning less than half an hour before noon in Chicago, and it was also 3 days before Christmas. Obviously, the weather conditions and the amount of pedestrians and vehicles on the road are probably going to be a lot different when the detectives reenacted Brandon's drive months later. There are so many things you can't account for, which is why the time of their test runs range from 6 to 12 minutes, and even though they calculated the amount of time it took Brandon to drive that route, they didn't really account for how much time it would have taken for him to go in and out of all the locations he visited, particularly when he went into his house to murder his wife. If this crime had been a simple case of Donna being shot multiple times, then I can believe John might have been able to walk inside, kill her, and then leave again within a matter of a few minutes. But she was also strangled with an ironing cord, had bruises on her body, and there were signs of struggle in the utility room. A pathologist testified that he believed the cord was around her neck for at least 15 minutes, but even if you discount his assessment, why would John bother to strangle Donna in the first place? I mean, it's not like Donna is going to panic and put up a struggle if her own husband walks into the house. All he has to do is pull out a gun and shoot her before she even has a time to react. Now, I'm not sure how thoroughly John was checked for scratches, marks, or other injuries, but it doesn't look like he exhibited any signs of being in a struggle, even though the scene suggested Donna had attempted to fight someone off. It's a shame that the evidence taken from Donna's fingernails were lost by police, as it might have shed more light on who her potential attacker was. Donna was also shot in the aorta, which likely would have caused blood to spurt out. John didn't appear to have any traces of blood on him, and he certainly wouldn't have had much time to clean himself, given that he had to leave the scene immediately. And there's also the fact that the murder weapon was never found. I know police apparently received a tip that Brannion had disposed of a gun in Lake Michigan, but there's no way he would have been able to travel to Lake Michigan during that time frame. So if Brannion was the shooter, then he'd have to stash the weapon someplace where it wouldn't be found, drive to the nursery school, and then dispose of the gun at a later time. Of course, there's also the Brannion's next-door neighbor, Teresa Kentra, who claims she heard noises which sounded like gunshots sometime between 11:20 and 11:30 when John was still at the hospital. I know we have another neighbor who was certain he heard loud noises at 11:36, but even if he's accurate, it's still cutting it pretty close for Brannion to have arrived at the house by then. The problem is that it's hard to nail down an exact time when he left the hospital. At the minimum, he left as early as 11:30, but given that he briefly chatted with the administrator while leaving, it could have been as late as 11:35. Either way, it seems like a bit of a stretch for Brannion to be at his house and shooting his wife as early as 11:36. And let's not forget that the Brannion residence wasn't in the middle of nowhere. This crime took place shortly before noon in a suburban neighborhood, so it just seems very risky for Brannion to do this. We know some of the neighbors did hear noises, but if any of them had actually seen Brannion entering or leaving his house, then this would totally destroy his attempt at creating an alibi for himself. The one red flag which might seem to point to Brannion being the perpetrator is that he originally told police that he arrived at the nursery school at 11:35 and picked up Joby outside, even though the teacher said he arrived at 11:45 and went inside the building to collect Joby. I could forgive John for getting the time wrong, but claiming that Joby was outside instead of inside is a pretty big discrepancy. It's almost like he's trying to shave 10 minutes off his arrival time to make people think there was no possible way he could have traveled to his house. However, Brannion's supporters have always insisted that the police got this detail wrong, and that he never actually told them he arrived at 11:35 and picked up Joby outside. But overall, I really don't think it would have been possible for Brannion to have committed this murder. The timeline was just way too narrow, and I find it very unlikely Brannion would have had the time to pull all this off in only 25 minutes. So therefore, he should not have been found guilty of this crime. However, and this is the big elephant in the room with this case, the third theory is that Brannion did not actually kill his wife, but hired someone else to do it. Now, it must be said that no one uncovered any evidence Brannion orchestrated a murder-for-hire scheme, but when you look at how these events unfolded, this scenario would make a lot of sense. It was theorized that the only reason Brannion invited Maxine Brown on a lunch date with him that day was to fabricate an alibi for himself and have an additional witness for when he walked into his house and discovered his wife's body. I know that Nelson and some of the other guests at his dinner party refuted Maxine's claim that John called her up late at night out of the blue to invite her to lunch, but even if her version is incorrect, and John and Donna both invited her out, it does seem like quite a coincidence that Donna would end up murdered right before their lunch date took place. When John picked up Joby at the nursery school, the teacher described him as looking rushed, as he seemed to be dressing Joby in his winter clothes and hustling him out of the school as quickly as possible, which does lend credence to the idea that he wanted to get home as quickly as possible in order to establish his alibi. And even though Teresa Kentra was one of the defense's key witnesses, she did claim she saw John's face right before he ran outside to scream Helen Hudson's name, and that he did not appear to be agitated, almost as if he had known he would find his wife's body, and was now ready to play the role of the grieving husband.
Thank you.
Personally, one thing I've always found most suspicious is when Brandon was asked if he wanted to take a polygraph test, and he said no, but he'd be willing to take a nitrate test to show that he had never fired a gun that day. I don't hold the fact that he refused to take a polygraph against him, but it's weird that he would bring up the subject of a nitrate test himself. Quite frankly, I can't think of another murder case where a suspect flat out volunteered to take a nitrate or gunshot residue test without even being asked. I imagine this thought wouldn't even cross most people's minds, especially after finding out a loved one has been murdered. And this is 1967, where there's no internet or an abundance of CSI or true crime shows, so how many people are going to know what a nitrate test is? Granted, since Brandon was a gun collector, he might have had more knowledge about the subject than most, but the fact that he brought it up strongly suggests to me that this idea was in the back of Brandon's mind and part of his plan all along. If he hired someone else to murder his wife, and a nitrate test showed that he hadn't fired a gun that day, then he'd pretty much be in the clear and eliminated as a suspect. Of course, the police didn't have the resources to perform this test at the time, but if they had, and there was no trace of gunshot residue on Brandon's hands, then it probably would have been very difficult, if not impossible, to charge him with murder and get a conviction. There are some things about Brandon's action that day which seem pretty calculated, almost as if he had orchestrated his wife's murder, but took steps to ensure he wouldn't be anywhere near the scene when it happened. Like I said earlier, no one ever uncovered any evidence that Brandon hired anyone to commit the murder, and this theory is all just speculation, but in my opinion, it's the theory which makes the most sense, because there are too many things which prevent me from thinking he's 100% innocent. Namely, the fact that his Walther PPK and four shells from a box of ammunition just happened to go missing. Now, there is some debate about whether Donna was actually shot four times. Even though four bullets and cartridge casings were found at the scene, Donna had 13 gunshot wounds on her. Some of them were exit wounds, and one of the bullets remained lodged in Donna's body, though it's possible the three remaining bullets passed through multiple parts of her body. However, Brandon's defenders argued that she would have had to be shot at least 6 or 7 times to make that many wounds, which might mean that the missing four shells from the ammunition box have no relevance to this case. Well, I'm pretty skeptical about that because those missing shells match the specific type of bullets and cartridges found at the murder scene, and there's never been any other logical explanation to account for why those four shells went missing. It's implied that the police could have made those shells disappear in order to fabricate evidence, but given that only four bullets and cartridge casings were ever found, not 6 or 7, I do tend to believe the official version that Donna was shot with the missing Walther PPK, which fired off those four missing shells. And if this murder was committed by burglars or a random home invader, then I don't understand why they would go into a closet and find this particular gun and load it with these particular bullets in order to shoot Donna. I know John maintained that he did not notice the Walther PPK was missing until after he was originally questioned by police, but why wouldn't he contact the police again to tell them it was missing? According to investigators, Brandon made no attempt to contact them at all after December 22nd, and he didn't mention anything about the gun being stolen until the day they showed up to arrest him. It's not like this particular brand of Walther PPK was a gun which would be carried around by your average run-of-the-mill street criminal, and they had a serial number on file for it. If you really wanted to catch your wife's killer, wouldn't you consider this to be a vital clue to share with the police? I know John claimed his brother-in-law advised him against reporting the theft to the police, because they were white cops and he was a black man and they might try to railroad him, but this decision wound up getting him arrested anyway. If it wasn't for the missing Walther PPK and the four shells, there really wouldn't have been much ground to charge Brandon with the murder, but that is a pretty damning piece of evidence. While I don't believe anyone uncovered anything incriminating in Brandon's financial records, such as a large withdrawal of money which could have been used to pay someone to murder his wife, John did claim he left $500 on the dresser for Donna, and that it turned up missing, which he also never reported to the police. Perhaps this $500 was the payoff, and whoever killed Donna took it after the job was done. Yes, $500 is not a lot of money to perform a murder, but given the sloppy nature of Donna's murder, I have my doubts that whoever was responsible was some sort of skilled contract killer. Now, in Brandon's defense, You might be wondering why he'd be stupid enough to supply one of his own guns as the murder weapon. Well, the best explanation might be that John wasn't stupid, but his hired killer or killers were. The pathologists believe that Donna had the ironing cord around her neck for around 15 to 30 minutes before she was shot. The perpetrators might have made an attempt to strangle her to death, but were so inept at their job that they couldn't actually apply enough pressure to kill her. Since they didn't bring their own gun with them, one of the killers restrained Donna, while the other searched the house for another weapon to finish the job. They came across the Walther PPK and the box of ammunition for it, and used it to shoot Donna before fleeing the scene and disposing of the weapon elsewhere. It was just John's bad luck that the perpetrators happened to select a very distinctive gun from his collection, which could easily be traced back to him. Now, to be fair, this exact same scenario could have unfolded with intruders who weren't part of a murder-for-hire plot, and Brannion had nothing to do with it. But the problem is that there's no other motive for this murder which makes sense. Unless Donna had other enemies besides her husband, who wanted her dead, I just don't see why random attackers would be compelled to enter a suburban home in the middle of the day to kill this woman. She was not sexually assaulted, and the only items which turned up missing were the Walther PPK, another antique gun, and $500, but we really only have Brannion's word that these items were stolen, since he never reported them to the police. Yes, it was theorized that these burglars might have killed Donna because she didn't have the combination to open a safe, but John still had 30 guns in his collection, and the house had other valuables which were never touched, so it really does not seem like robbery was the motive here. Nothing about the way this murder unfolded makes sense, and yes, you believe John orchestrated it. The only other possible theory is that this was an elaborate setup to frame Brannion for murder, considering that he was a black civil rights activist with connections to Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers during a very racially charged era. But I don't know, even though his activities did bring him some heat from the police and the state's attorney's office, I just don't think Dr. Brannion was a prominent enough figure to compel someone to orchestrate a frame-up job. Just because you were Martin Luther King's physician does not necessarily make you public enemy number one. If someone in power was that bound and determined to put Brannion in prison, I don't think he ever would have been released on a $5,000 bond and allowed to remain free for 3 years while appealing his murder conviction. All that being said, if the scenario I just outlined is true, then technically, Dr. Brannion did not receive a fair trial, and this was still a wrongful conviction. Because he was not tried for soliciting the murder, he was tried for committing the murder himself. And since I do believe the evidence showed he just did not have enough time to commit the murder, and his defense team did an effective job at generating reasonable doubt, Brannion should not have been found guilty. Given the issues with the prosecution's timeline, I'm surprised the jury was able to convict him after only deliberating 8 hours, but if 11 of the 12 jurors hadn't been white, who knows if things might have turned out differently. During the Unsolved Mystery segment, the original prosecutor, Patrick Tuitt, is interviewed, and he admits it's possible Brannion did not pull the trigger himself, but hired someone else to do it, and that this idea even crossed his mind at the time the trial took place. And then the segment cuts to Brannion, who becomes pretty irate at the accusation that he hired someone to murder his wife, and states that if there was any evidence of that, why didn't they produce it? And I hate to say this, but I gotta agree with Brannion on this one. If the police and prosecutors actually believed Brannion hired someone to perform the murder, then they should not have charged him with murder, especially when there was considerable doubt about whether it was physically possible for him to commit the crime. However, there was no direct evidence of a murder-for-hire plot, but there was some circumstantial evidence suggesting Brannion might be the killer, so that's why they went the second route. You might be of the mindset that if Brannion was guilty of something, then it didn't matter what they charged him with, just as long as they put him behind bars. However, that's not how the justice system works. And I'm not saying this because I have any sympathy for Brannion. Putting aside the ethical debates, if Brannion hired someone else to kill his wife, then that means there were one or more people out there getting away with murder. If they charge Brannion with being the actual trigger man and get him convicted, then they can completely close the case. But even though a guilty man is behind bars, someone else who killed a woman gets away scot-free. And overall, that's the thing which bothers me most about this case. If you think John Brannion is guilty in some way, then ultimately, karma did get him in the end. Yes, he got an extra several years of freedom, but he did spend a lot of them running around the globe and constantly looking over his shoulder. I think that probably took a major toll on his health, and might have led to his multiple heart attacks. I suppose there's poetic justice in the fact that a once-respected physician who would ordinarily be at the top of the waiting list for a heart transplant wound up being denied that benefit because he was convicted of murder. But the way this entire thing unfolded does raise a lot of troubling ethical questions. Ultimately, when it comes to my opinion on Brannion's guilt or innocence, I lean towards the murder-for-hire theory. I do acknowledge that there's no hard evidence of him hiring anyone to kill his wife, but there are a lot of suspicious things which make me believe there's no way Brannion is 100% innocent in this whole affair. But from a legal standpoint, Brannion probably was 100% innocent of the crime he was actually charged with, so he should not have been convicted. The Chicago PD was apparently facing a lot of pressure from the black press to bring Donna Brannion's killer to justice. When they saw a lot of things about her husband which made them suspicious, they zeroed in on him, but were premature when they decided to arrest him for murder. They really should have had more patience and dug deeper to see if there were multiple people involved in this crime besides Brannion, and gathered enough evidence to bring everyone to justice. If that had happened, then people might not still be debating this case 50 years later. Anyway, because John Brannion has passed away, this case is technically closed, and no one is investigating it anymore. But if the murder-for-hire theory is correct, there is at least one other person out there who has never faced justice for this crime, though they are likely dead by now. Even so, if you happen to have any information that someone else besides John Brannion was involved in the murder of Donna Brannion, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give a shout out to all my supporters from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. We also have a pair of new donors this week named Chase and Brett, so thank you very much, guys. Since we've entered a new month, it's about time we gave a special shout-out to our recurring monthly donors, and they are Don, Amber, Brian, Casey, Ellie, Kathleen, Keisha, Laura, Alice, Clinton, Lewis, Jennifer, and Aura. Thanks so much for your generosity. And just another reminder that if you're looking to purchase some new socks for the winter, please check out our new sponsor, Sock Club, and receive a 15% discount if you visit sockclub.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. If you use their product, you'll never again have to utter those horrifying words, the feet.
I just want to express my thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. And last month, we also opened a new online store and are now selling Trail Went Cold merchandise, such as t-shirts, mugs, and stickers, so feel free to visit our website, trailwentcold.com, and click the store button if you wish to purchase anything. Remember, we've entered the month of December and are only a few weeks away from Christmas, so this merchandise might make a nice gift for any true crime podcast fanatics you know. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do that.